This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our guest is Nat Gandhi. Today we're talking about autobiography, his autobiography. And I would like to know, Nat, what is your title of your book?
It's called Still the Promised Land.
And what is the book about?
Book is primarily about my own upbringing in India, how I was raised in India, what I went through in Mumbai. And then through sheer luck, I came to America and shows my journey in America over the last 50 years.
What made you write this book now?
Two things. One is that I wanted to go through, once I retired, I wanted to go through my life's journey and reflect back on it. But more than that, I wanted to emphasize that America is still the promised land for people like me. All this anti-immigrant talk that we keep hearing all the time does not do the justice of how great a country it is. And it, despite all that, I would say it is still the promised land. And that's why I put a title to that.
And in spite and because of that theme, this is a fascinating book. Your life should be a technicolored movie. It is so interesting and so fun. It's such easy reading. Well, I would like to tell everyone who you are.
If there is a movie, I would like it to be called The Other Gandhi.
Oh, wouldn't that be a perfect title? Let's work on it. Well, Nat is very well known in Washington, D.C., because he was the tax commissioner and the CFO of the city. He is known for coming into a city that was in ruins and deficit, and he transformed it to a healthy city out of the red and into the black. And so for that, you are a hero. And you do not claim that for yourself, so we'll have to do it for you.
Well, very kind of you. If I may interrupt, I think I played a key role, but Mayor Anthony Williams, the control board, the council, all of them were there, no doubt.
I think you always need a team
exactly
to do
right.
it, and you just happened to have the right mayor and the right team, and you brought the city from a city that was actually in decay.
That is correct.
To a gleaming city that was without debt. That is something, that's a lot to put on a tombstone.
That is true. City is financially extraordinarily in good condition.
But let us take us to the book and your very beginnings. Where were you born and in what circumstance? Who lived in your house? How many children?
Right. So I was born in western part of India. I grew up in an extended family that included parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles and siblings. In addition to these basic 14 people, there are many others who would come and go and stay and go away and come back. It was rather a primitive place when you compare to any American small town.
What was the name of this town?
It was called Savarkundala. Actually, it was it's two small villages divided by a river, common river. And that is why it is called Savarkundala. River, you know, is we call it river, but it's nothing but a small stream of water.
Okay.
But that was the only water supply we had in town. There was no running water. I still remember my mother and sisters carrying drinking waters home. There was no electricity. I still remember studying on kerosene lamp. Dogs and cats roam the street.
And how hard your mother must have worked.
Right.
And this book is a testament to that. It's a very important document, I believe. So just read us a little section of the book.
Sure. And this is, again, my tribute to America. For an immigrant with skills, America is heaven. If you know what you want to do with your life, and are willing to work at it, America is the place to come. Only in America can an Asian immigrant like me become the chief financial officer of the nation's capital. This nation's generous people opened their hearts and doors to immigrants like me and let them pursue their dreams. And that is why America is still the most favorite destination for tens of millions around the world. The best and the brightest, as well as the tired and the poor, come to America, invited or not. Surveys show and images from the evening news confirm that people want to come here, even risking their lives. My story is both cautionary and instructive, difficult yet uplifting. Ultimately, it is a harrowing tale of how to survive in India and succeed in America. It was an uncertain beginning, in some ways even more difficult than immigrants face today.
Mm.
In this winter of American discontent, when a presidential candidate rode into White House based in part on his anti-immigrant rhetoric, it is rather quaint to say, as I do, America is still the promised land for immigrants like me, especially when Indians and Asians have been targets of some of the worst violence against America's newcomers. In singing America's glory, I'm not ignoring what is bad and ugly here: crime, drugs, social promiscuity, homelessness, racial discrimination, and toxic, special interest-driven tribal politics. And yes, I too feel the sting of discrimination, crank calls from the crazies telling me to go back home. But where would I go? After being here for more than 50 years, this is my home, now and forever. Most Americans take their country for granted. I don't. I know better. I am from the old world, where America is still the place to go. I'm a citizen now and celebrate July 4th. But the day of my biggest celebration each year is October 10th. On that day, in 1965, I landed in America. That is my Independence Day.
That is the stirring rhetoric we will find in this poem, as long as heartfelt, personal, human stories of a person's growth. And we can tell by your writing that you are a learned, very learned scholar and a very literate. Which brings me to a part in the book that made me smile. When you were small, you were an avid reader, and the librarian said to your father, "He is such a nuisance." What was that about?
Well, you know, as backward as the town it was, there were two things which provided me refuge. One was a movie theater, which ran on a generator, since we had no electricity. And other one was a very old, dilapidated place, library, with old books and benches full of bugs. Anyway, that is where I went for every waking hour that I can find, and libraries were open. And as if it was not enough for me to be there, I would bring books home. Well, books in those days were under lock and key. So if I want a particular book, the librarian would have to get up, find the key, open the cabinet, and bring the book to me. He didn't like that at all. So one day I said, "I want this particular book." And he said, "No, we don't have it. We'll order it." And I said, "I just saw it in the case." He didn't like that. He got up, get the book, and dump it in my lap and gave me a look that I will not ever forget.
And then,
as I was going home, he followed me and he told my father, "Don't you have things to do for this man, young man? He bothers me for all kinds of books. Find some work for him." And my father said, "What are you talking about?" He said, yes, he comes there every day. So my father was very angry with me and said, "Why don't you stay home or come to my shop and help me do some chores?" And then I went back home and told my mother, "It's about time to send Natu," that is my nickname, "to Mumbai and start working."
Oh.
So within a week, I was ready to go to Mumbai, and librarian would never have to worry about me. So he had a last laugh.
Just in one sentence, how would you describe your mother?
Very caring, deeply religious, and would do anything for children and for people.
But work was the way they showed their love.
Well, basically, you know, these are not the way Americans would show that love for children, like celebrating birthdays, nothing of that sort.
How about hugging and kissing?
Not much. It is not very prevalent in India to do that. Mm-hmm.
And your father had a business and was very busy.
He had a small business, and you are right. You know, he was busy really making enough to make both ends meet. And it is a hard work. So he had no time for anything else. But at the end of the day, you know, these are very caring people, and we hold no grudge against them for not doing the American things.
Oh, that is true, and it shows shining in your book.
Thank you.
At one point, now you are a world-class accountant with a PhD, but at one point you didn't become accountant, you were going to be a poet. So tell us about that choice.
Well, when I came to Mumbai to work, where I was working as basically a gopher, you know, Gandhi, go and get some tea, that kind of gopher. And one of my relatives came and said, you know, you ought to go to college. You can do this all your life. And I said, yeah, I would love to go, but I have no money. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And so I said, okay, we are going to college now. And I said, I want to specialize in literature. I want to write poetry. And my cousin, who was actually bankrolling me or financing my education, he gave me a tongue lashing that I will never forget. And he said, are you kidding me? I'm giving all that money for you to go to college, and you want to write poetry? Who is going to give you a job with poetry? Get into accounting. That's what I did.
But they can't kill the poet within. And so therefore, you're going to read us a poem in two languages.
That's right.
This is Nat Gandhi. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress with a beautiful autobiography called Still the Promised Land. And Gandhi has made Washington what it is today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. This poem is a sonnet. It's on Mahatma Gandhi, the other Gandhi. Every time I go to India, I make it a point to visit Gandhi's communal abode, Sabarmati Ashram, on the banks of River Sabarmati. And it is from that place that Gandhi started his salt march to the sea in 1932. To me, this ashram or abode is among the most sacred places in India. It's a place of pilgrimage. From its appearance, it's quite a simple, not impressive at all. However, from this very ordinary place, he started a revolution with only about 80 followers and marched to the sea. His message and the method have had profound impact all over the world ever since. So here is the sonnet. First, I would recite in English and then in Gujarati, my native language. And it's also the native language of Mahatma Gandhi and the native language of the present Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. It's a language spoken by 40 plus million people, full-fledged language with literature and all that. But here is the English version. At the Sabarmati Ashram, there is no marble palace here, no imperial lodge, no formidable fortress, no great fort, no tall towers here, no army, no armory, no arsenal full of weapons, not even a structure of any architectural significance. There is nothing here really of any consequence. All I see here are a few huts. However, it is here that an old man started his campaign to defeat a world power and its mighty army. All he had with him was his walking stick and only a few followers, the happy few. And armed with a power of truth and nonviolence, and God by his side, he challenged that mighty army and said, "Do what you will. I will die a death of a dog, but will not return until I secure freedom for my people. It is do or die for me." The great march that he started here to reach the ocean turned itself into a great ocean itself. An ocean of revolution that went around the world, conquering hearts and minds of people and their armies on many shores, far and near. So now it's a Gujarati version of that, or that's original Gujarati. Again, it's a sonnet. Ahi nathi jaraj mandir, na mahal mahalatana, na durg nathi harmyako, nathi vishasht sthapatyava, na hasti graha shastra sangrahana, ashvashala nathi kutir dasabara matra, basajo mua ashrame. Ahi jakasika chadi, kamar hath lai lakadi, kapal kari chandalo, harinunam hote dari, अमोग सत शास्त्र सज्ज जुज साथि संगे तमे अहिंज जगरज्जनी सहु समर्थ अक्षौहिणी बुलंद पड़कारिति करव होयते ल्योकरी नथीज नथी आवमु विण स्वराज पाछू हवे भले मरण आवतु मरिश कागड़ा कूतरा समान पण नाचना पगमुकीश हूँ आश्रमे अहिंज અહીંથી શરૂ થયું મહાન પ્રસ્થાન જે વિશાળ પ્રસર્યું પછી ઉર ઉરે દુરે ચોદિશે.
વેરી બ્યુટિફુલ. Nat Gandhi, they can take you out of the country, but they can't take the poet out of you.
Thank you.
Is Gujarati the most elevated language in India?
There are 14 other major languages that are all, most of them are derived from Sanskrit. It's like Latin. And this is one of the languages.
And that Gandhi spoke that.
Gandhi's native language. Indeed, he wrote his autobiography in Gujarati.
Oh, that is so interesting. And you then became a PhD. So the librarian should just know about that, what happened to you. And how you went to LSU.
Right.
And why did you end up in New Orleans?
Well, it was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana,
yes.
And I was a student at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and at that time, my wife and I were expecting a baby, and I needed married student quarters, and Chapel Hill did not have for us. So I was looking for a place, and LSU offered me a fellowship and married student's quarters.
But how was your English?
Oh, my English was very good by that time. The problem with English was from my little place, Savarkundala, when I went to Mumbai, that is when I was lost with my English, because education in my place, Savarkundala, was all in Gujarati, my mother tongue. Everything in Gujarati. I never had seen a book in English, not even seen it.
But in Mumbai,
everything is in
you
English.
You cultivated English?
I had, that's a nice way to put it, but in college when I went there, everything was in English. Medium of instruction was English. So I couldn't follow the professor for months. For months I couldn't follow it. And I said, my God, where have I come? How would I measure this? How would I pass the examinations? But with a dictionary of English Gujarati in one hand and a textbook in other, I started learning this. So within 6 months, I was able to follow the professors. And after, you know, 5-6 years in Mumbai, I was quite proficient in English.
And very proficient. I'm holding up this book, Still the Promised Land by Nat Gandhi. What is your real name in
Gujarati? Well, it's a long one. It's a Natwar Lal, but they all Americanized as a Nat.
Or Natwar.
Or Natwar.
Yes. Yeah. And it is a stunning read.
Thank
of
you.
Someone who tells what is in the heart as well as what is in the world.
Thank you.
It is a friendly book for any reader. It is not about accounting, nothing personal about your career, but it is about the human heart and the journey that you've made.
So my experience at Atlanta University and at North Carolina A&T really prepared me for diversity of America and got me in close contact with African Americans. So when I came to Washington, D.C. and became the chief financial officer of Washington, D.C., at that time a black city, predominantly black city, I had never any problem.
That makes perfect sense. And you also, when you went to New York, it interested me very much, you couldn't believe the civility in the offices there.
That
you said
right.
Nobody was shouting at each other.
Right.
Everyone was, you were just stunned at the civilized behavior. However, you have endured other behavior. So let's hear about what happened when you were walking on the street in Wisconsin Avenue.
That was quite an event.
Yes, it was an awakening, wasn't it?
Awakening. And I couldn't believe that could happen. In the summer of 2017, I was driving along Wisconsin Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland, one of the most prosperous neighborhoods of suburban Washington. On my way to the nation's capital, I stopped at a light by the Bethesda Naval Hospital, a premier medical center that has served presidents, congressmen, senators, and other Washington bigwigs since 1940. It is also near the headquarters of National Institutes of Health, where cutting-edge medical research is conducted. A car pulled up on my right. I watched the window slide down, and a man's face turned my way. Thinking he needed assistance, perhaps directions, I pressed the button to open the window on my passenger side. "Can I help you?" I asked. "Yeah," he said, leaning toward me and shouting, "get out of my country. Why didn't you go back to where you come from?" Shocked and tongue-tied, I froze and couldn't respond. He drove off, his mission accomplished. I just sat there staring at the green light. As cars behind me started honking, I regained my composure and continued down the avenue. I reached for words that I wish I had said. I could have said, "I have lived in America since 1965, probably before you were born." Or, "I'm an American citizen, as are my two children and five grandchildren." Or, "This is my country. I just came from Maryland and now presently going to Washington, D.C. That is my home now." As I reflect on my checkered life, I have many regrets. But coming to America is not one of them. In fact, it is the best thing that happened to me. It was here in America that I found my life's calling. America gave me the opportunity to make something of myself. For that, I'm grateful to its ever-generous people and the tradition of welcoming people from distant shores.
And that is in the book, along with a very personal journey, and that wound and wounds like that still did not deter you from thinking this is just one off, this is not what America is. How did you get involved with Mayor Williams and become our tax commissioner and our chief financial officer of Washington, D.C.?
Right. As you pointed out, that in mid-90s, city was in financial disarray. We had something like $500+ million deficit in our fund balance, meaning we were that much in red in our saving account, primarily because our tax system was dysfunctional, didn't work. At that time, Anthony Williams was the chief financial officer, and he was looking for a tax commissioner. And earlier, when I was working with the federal government, so-called GAO, General Accounting Office then, I did a lot of work in the taxation, worked very closely with the Internal Revenue Service. So I was quite well-known in that limited circle of tax experts. So he invited me, Mr. Williams invited me to join the district as a tax commissioner, we had very tough time in reorganizing the tax department.
How long did that take?
It took us about 3 to 4 years to bring back the taxation in some order.
And I must say, this is all in your book, and everyone can hear the details of that, the drama of that, the success of that, and we will now hear a final reading.
Right. Okay. So, you hear a lot about American decline. And as an immigrant, I would say that only an immigrant knows how great the country is, and America is not in decline. Mm. So here is what I say. I predict that 21st century will be an American century, much the same way 20th century was an American century, as pronounced by Henry Luce, founder of Time and Life magazines. This might sound Pollyannish, given the current national mood of gloom and doom. Why am I so bullish on America? Despite the present winter of our discontent, I see America as a triumphant nation that has provided an unprecedentedly high standards of living and freedom of expression to the majority of its heterogeneous people. No other country has done it on such a vast scale. Mm. America has made a good life possible even for the common man and woman. It gives people a chance to make something of their lives by liberating them from crushing burden of poverty that plagues much of the world. Any country that can do it within mere 200 years of its formation should not be called tragic, as some would have it. But it is more than that what America has done for its material well-being of its people. Here, in America, one gets a chance to remake life and make one's mark. I got a chance to remake my life, a life that would have been wasted in India. As immigrants remake their lives, they also remake the country. 100 or so years ago, when Italians, Jews, Poles, and other Europeans were knocking at America's door, the great American commentator Walter Lippmann, unlike others, was not afraid of these hordes of new immigrants. In fact, he said, these immigrants brought with them 1,000 unforeseeable possibilities. The great social adventure of America is no longer the conquest of wilderness, but the absorption of 50 different peoples. Immigration may swamp us. It may, if we seize the opportunity, means the impregnation of our national life with new brilliancy.
That is the voice of Nat Gandhi reading from the autobiography, Still the Promised Land. This program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, ME2 Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.